Sermon will be brought to us this afternoon by Mr. Mark Kaplan. But before that, Tammy Fatteros is going to sing a vocal solo, In His Presence, and then the sermon from Mr. Kaplan.
Good afternoon, everyone. To those who remember some of my Hebrew classes, Shabbat Shalom. It's really I can't express enough my appreciation for the opportunity to address this group here. So I won't really take a lot of time with it, but I'm just overwhelmed and really appreciate the chance to share the information with you that I want to share this afternoon. I certainly did appreciate the special music, and I also appreciated being introduced by Mr. Orchard. It's a fulfillment of a prophecy in Isaiah about the time coming when Ephraim shall not envy Judah and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. At least we're beginning to live that now in advance. You know, sometimes a person never lives down a mistake. There's a Mr. Selig's father-in-law, Mr. Mishnick, has been in the ministry for many years. Some years ago, I was speaking in La Mirada. I think it was on the last day of Unleavened Bread, some years back. And Mr. Selig had the sermonette. So at the end of my sermon, I got very eloquent, I hope, you know, very enthusiastic. And I said, let's remember what Mr. Mishnick told us earlier. And, you know, I went on and on about that several times. And I guess he's never allowed me to forget what I did to him. Well, we've got the autumn festivals coming up. We've already heard announcements regarding those plans that are being made. And at that time, you know, as the autumn festivals are coming up, we would tend to have our minds on Bible prophecy to some degree. And I wanted to discuss a subject relating to Bible prophecy today. It's an area that has always been a special interest of mine. Even, I suppose, it's an area that helped to draw my attention to the church years ago, to what Mr. Armstrong had to say. But before I get into that, I want to, in effect, prepare in advance lest people misunderstand what I'm trying to do or the material that I'm getting into. I brought an old book with me. As you see, it's an old Hebrew book. It's not that old. I don't mean it's ancient or anything. I'm a baby boomer. I'm the same age as President Clinton. And, of course, our generation now has taken over. You can evaluate the results. But in my teenage years in the early 60s, I was presented with this prayer book, and it's an interesting inscription inside. It says, presented to Mark Kaplan by Congregation Avath Achim. That was my congregation. It means brotherly love. It's kind of like the Hebrew equivalent of Philadelphia. So I was a part of this congregation Avath Achim, and it was presented to me in honor of attendance at services. So you could just imagine, I guess, how desperate they must have been for YOUH children to be attending services. They actually gave you a free prayer book if you attended regularly. But obviously, somebody growing up in that kind of an environment is going to be very sensitive to bigotry, to prejudice, to racism. I used to walk back and forth to services on the Sabbath. We had three services every Sabbath. So in the evening, I would walk to services, and then in the morning, I'd walk to services and back again. And then in the late afternoon, I'd walk to services and back again. And usually, I walked with older men because young people didn't go to services, as I was saying. You know, that's why they gave out books. So I didn't. I had some teenage friends, but a lot of my friends were men who were older than I was. They were old enough to be my parents. And I was a baby boomer, so that means these were people who had survived World War II. They were Holocaust survivors. You can imagine the stories I heard going back and forth all the time between services, the stories I heard from these Holocaust survivors. And so I'm the last person who wants to encourage, you know, whatever you want to call it, neo-Nazism or fascism or bigotry and prejudice. And so it may very well be that much of the material that I cover today, because it has been misused, because it has been abused out in the world, especially at this time, it may not be the first subject that we as a church choose to make a major issue of publicly. I understand that, and I'm not pushing for it necessarily. But within our own community, there's information that I want to share with God's people that I think we appreciated learning and that we would appreciate reviewing. So this afternoon, we shall examine some aspects of the subject of the United States and Britain in prophecy. I know it's somewhat controversial, but as I said, there's information that within our own community we want to remember and appreciate and utilize in our own personal Bible study. And the leadership can determine at what point and in what way, we want to deal with the information regarding the wider world. But this afternoon we shall examine, in the time we have, some aspects of the subject of the United States and Britain in prophecy. I've entitled this sermon, I had kind of a long title, I called it Refreshing Our Memory of a Master Key to Prophecy. And then Mr. Michaud forced me to shorten it, so now let's just call it Remembering a Master Key to Prophecy. Remembering a Master Key to Prophecy. I was reminded this afternoon about the title of the booklet. We publish material, obviously, in the Spanish language, and the United Church of God has material in the Spanish language. New Beginnings is now being published in Spanish. So years ago, when the United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy was being published and distributed, there was a Spanish version, and one of the Spanish versions was entitled La Llave Maestra de la Profecía, The Master Key to Prophecy. That was the title it had in Spanish. I've got to be working on my Spanish now. We have the opportunity this year to attend the Feast of Tabernacles in Veracruz, which is, we're really thrilled about having that opportunity. So anyway, in the Spanish language, it was called La Llave Maestra de la Profecía. And it really is a master key to understanding prophecy, and something that I think we all appreciated learning about as we learned about it. And again, because I was growing up in a synagogue environment as a child, I had heard legends about the lost tribes, and I had heard speculation concerning the lost tribes and the future of the reunion of the tribes. These were things that were a part of my childhood. We had a legend about a river. I should have reviewed about it before I got here. This is just off the top of my head. There was a river called the Sambatión, and according to the legends, the lost tribes lived on the other side of that river. And there are, I think, two versions of the story. One version is that the river flowed all through the week, but on the Sabbath it stopped flowing. It sort of rested. And then there's another version to the story, is that the river normally didn't flow, but on the Sabbath, when the people rested, the river did flow to protect them. I think I've heard both versions of it. Now, one of these days, you're liable to walk into church and hear a piece of special music called something, I think it's called The River in Judea. And if you remember the words, those of you who are singers, I think that piece of special music is based on that legend of the river that flows and rests on the Sabbath, and on the other side of that river are the descendants of the lost tribes. So growing up, I heard stories about the lost tribes and legends about where they might be and so forth. And obviously it was something that, really fascinated me. And one of the greatest thrills of my life, personally, was to be involved, finally, years later, after much later than my teenage years, being actually involved in producing a piece of literature on the subject, or at least, helping in that regard. You know that Mr. Armstrong, many years ago, wrote The United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy. And over the years, different editions of that book have come out. And I personally feel that the best edition that ever was published, which had a very brief career, was this one with a tan cover that was produced in 1986. It is actually the ninth edition, and there are not that many copies available. It says in this copy here, 1986, 125,000 copies were made of this particular version of the United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy. It was made in 1986, which, as you know, was the year of Mr. Armstrong's death. And I believe we came together and worked on it after his death. So I actually had a hand in writing some of what was in this particular edition, which in all you, we heard about humility in the sermonette. But nevertheless, I think it was, I still think it was the best edition that we ever came out with on this. And it didn't last very long. It had a very brief career, and there are not that many copies of this around. But I don't think I'm going to have time to read anything out of it, but it was a thrill to be involved in some way with that, because that information is information that I really appreciate. So as I said, in the time we have remaining, I want to get into it some. I can't cover it all in one sermon, but I want to at least refresh our memory, because a lot of us know a lot of this material anyway. We're familiar with a lot of it. So let's just refresh our memory about it. And let's go to Acts 1 and verse 6 as an introduction here. And realize that the identity of the lost tribes and the reunion of the tribes was something that was on the minds of the early church as well, on the minds of the apostles, because they were aware of the prophecies. As they looked forward to the fulfillment of prophecy, that was something that they looked forward to, was the restoration of Israel in its greatness, and that would have involved the reunion of the tribes. So we'll start in Acts 1 and verse 6. Therefore, now this is after Christ's resurrection. Therefore, when they had come together, they asked him, saying, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? So that's what that was on their minds right then. Christ had been resurrected. He'd gone through what he went through for them. And now that he was alive and in his full power, as he told them, they expected the fulfillment of the rest of these Bible prophecies about the Messiah and the fulfillment of the restoration of Israel. Well, as we know, it wasn't to happen then, but it was on their minds, and it would have involved a reunion of the two houses of Israel. There was one house that was lost. Let's go to Matthew now. Let's continue rather with Luke. No, let's go to Matthew. Matthew's account. We'll get to Luke again later. But let's go to Matthew's account in the 19th chapter. And verse 27. I want to show you that this is New Testament material that I'm dealing with. It is not just something for maybe a class in ancient history to maybe speculate about while visiting a museum or something. This was on the minds of the early church. We're talking here about prophecies that are yet to be fulfilled, and we're talking about material very directly related to the New Testament. We are obviously a New Covenant church. We all understand that. But in Matthew 19, verse 27... Then Peter answered and said to Christ, See, we have left all and followed you. Therefore, what shall we have? Well, that's a reasonable question. It may seem somewhat self-serving, but, you know, it's reasonable at times people wonder about such as that. You know, after all we've been through, you know, what happens on the other end of all this? So Jesus said to them, now this, he's speaking directly now to the 12 apostles. What was their specific reward? So Jesus said to them, Assuredly I say to you that in the regeneration, when the Son of Man sits on the throne of his glory, you who have followed me will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And so he, in effect, was promising each of them to have the opportunity to rule over one of the tribes of Israel. At that time, of course, the bulk of those tribes were already gone from history. They were not functioning as nations anymore. They didn't have a government, a specific territory that people knew about, etc. They had already been gone into exile and captivity for quite some time. And yet he promised each of the apostles would be ruling over one of the 12 tribes of Israel. So I want to go over some of that material today about the lost tribes of Israel, and some of the indications we have had in the past which caused us to identify where those tribes finally wound up in history and what the significance of that is. So let's go back to the early material and go from there and see, you know, as much time as we have, I'll get into it. And as I said, I can't exhaust the subject in one message. I want to go back to Genesis 12 is where we should really begin this. Let me say that the Bible, throughout the Bible, much of the history involves the history of Israel. Israel was the early church, the church of the Old Covenant. And it continued right on through the early years of the New Testament, as far as that's concerned, that much of the focus is on those peoples who are descendants of Israel. And throughout the history of Israel, there were in effect two branches of that nation, which was God's church in those days. There were, in effect, two branches. One that was given a specific promise involving that someday, from their very family, from that very nation, would emerge the King of Kings, the Messiah, the Christ, that he would come from that particular branch. But the other branch had tremendous physical blessings promised to it, blessings that were part of a birthright that were handed down from generation to generation, that in many ways, certainly from the physical point of view, were awesome. They don't equate with spiritual blessings, with having the Messiah coming from your branch, but they certainly would have been of a very sensational, major, important quality the way they are presented in the Bible. And those birthright blessings also were a factor. And when you read the history of Israel, at times you find one branch seems to be featured Sometimes the birthright branch seems to be the featured branch, and then the story tends to shift to the scepter branch, and it seems to go back and forth that way. The northern kingdom is featured at times, the southern kingdom is featured at times, and of course eventually the northern kingdom disappears, so only the southern kingdom remains, and God works with them as his church until Christ comes. But there's a sort of shift backwards and forwards through the history of the Bible, and right on through, as we'll see, even in prophecy. There's that shift of focus from north to south throughout, until there's a final reunion at the end of the story. And we haven't gotten there yet. We haven't arrived at the end of the story. But the story begins, in a sense, with Genesis 12. And by now, I guess you're all there. Here we start with Abraham, with one man, or Abram as he was named then. Abram was chosen in a specific way to leave where he was and, you know, his roots, to leave them behind and to move on. And then he continued to move on further, finally, to eventually settle in Canaan, as we know. And we're going to pick up what God tells him in Genesis 12. Now, the Eternal had said to Abram, I'm reading from a New King James translation through my message today. Now, the Eternal had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation." This is, of course, a very important promise to give to somebody. He was just an individual. He had a certain substance about him. He was, in a way, a patriarch of a clan. But now God says, "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So we have tremendous blessings that are showered upon Abraham in this sense. And they're blessings that are both physical and spiritual, as I said. They involve a birthright with tremendous physical blessings that were passed on, as we'll see. And they involve a spiritual blessing of someday being the ancestor of the one who would be the Savior. And they're both involved in these blessings in Genesis 12 and verse 3. And over time, they were, in effect, divided among his descendants. And there was a birthright branch and a scepter branch among his descendants. Let's go on then and see how these promises were passed on through Isaac and through his descendants, Isaac and Rebekah. In Genesis 24, we'll go a little farther as we, you know, continue on in this account. Just catching highlights, obviously. We can't go through all of this. Now, when Mr. Armstrong years ago wrote about these things, he had a talent for putting things in such a way that people would remember them. So he had these two catchwords, race and grace. And they're not necessarily problem terms. I guess you can turn them into that. You don't have to. Both of those terms, I guess, have become problems. They shouldn't be, though. He just used that as a way of understanding the nature of the blessings. One was physical, involving the birthright, and the other was spiritual, involving the scepter. So he used the term race and grace to just remember them. But in Genesis 24 and verse 60, notice as Isaac is about to marry Rebekah, we have another stage in the development of the people who are going to be the people through whom these promises are going to pass, through whom they're going to be fulfilled. And so this marriage is not just an arbitrary matter, a dime store romance kind of story. There's a very important perspective these people have in terms of the union of these two people. And in Genesis 24, and verse 59, as they're sending Rebekah away, in verse 60, "And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, 'Our sister, may you become the mother of thousands of ten thousands, and may your descendants possess the gates of those who hate them.'" So these are very powerful blessings to bestow upon somebody. These involve a national destiny when you look at it. These are very powerful words when really you play it all out. For the Bible to preserve the words in this way, one would expect major significance to be there. I want to now take it to Genesis 35 and see the next generation now, the generation of Jacob. And these promises are now passed down to the next generation. And there it begins to get more significant in terms of the fulfillment, because Jacob has 12 sons who in fact become the fathers of the nation of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel. Jacob's name is changed to Israel. and he becomes the father of that nation, which it was God's church under the old covenant. So in Genesis 35 and verse 11, we're going to Genesis 35 and verse 11, and we're talking now about Jacob, and God in verse 10 tells him, well, let's start with verse 10 to get the background here. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name. So he called his name Israel. So now the Bible goes back and forth between those terms. Sometimes you see the term Jacob, sometimes you see the term Israel. It refers both to the individual and, of course, to the nation of which he was the ancestor. And in verse 11, also God said to him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. Now these prophecies are very fundamental to understanding the developments of Bible prophecy. They're here in the book of Genesis. The Bible takes pains to record them, and specifically here and there to emphasize them again. And he tells him, be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you. So this ought to be something that a person objectively, with, you know, studying the Bible and close to God, can then look at historical events and see, well, where did this happen? How was this fulfilled fully in human history? Because we know the second part was fulfilled. When he talks about kings coming from your body, that, of course, does point to a royal line, which turned out to be the line of Judah and eventually David, specifically David, and, of course, eventually it led to Christ. So we understand the spiritual side of that, but there's a physical side that is not essential to know about, but certainly very interesting and helpful to know about. It's not a matter of salvation, but it certainly helps our understanding of the Scriptures. So we do see that here in Genesis 35, verse 11. Now we understand the story. We know the details of the story. Jacob had 12 sons. They became the ancestors of nations. And those nations together became the nation of Israel that God selected to be the first fruits of the nations, a nation that would follow his ways, which would supposed to be an example to the other nations. They would, in effect, say, see that way of life, see the example, and follow through themselves. Of course, it didn't work out that way because of the problems the Israelites had. He chose a people that were very stubborn, they were very stiff-necked. So I guess once you can deal with them, if you could ever convert them, you ought to be able to convert other people because they're so stubborn. But that's the way they were, unfortunately. But had they set the right example, they would have been then a model for other nations. So we have these 12 sons of Israel, as I said, who became the model, the basis of an entire nation of 12 tribes. If you go to Genesis 48, there's a particular focus on one of the children of Jacob, Joseph. Now, I later on may have time to go back and catch up a little bit more about the story of Joseph. You find several chapters in Genesis talking about Joseph. Genesis 37 through 45, a lot of that material particularly focuses on the career of Joseph. And yet, in there, there's an inset chapter, the 38th chapter, that focuses on another son of Jacob, Judah, who is the founder of the royal line, the line that eventually leads to Christ, to David and to Christ. So in that section of Genesis 37 to 45, that section talking about Joseph, who has the birthright, you also have a chapter dealing with Judah and dealing with the scepter. So as I said, all through the Bible you find that, the focus at times on the birthright, at times on the scepter. Many times in much of history, those promises seem separated. And yet history shows us that those promises will eventually come back together. And if we have some time towards the end, I'd like to comment on that. But in Genesis 48, the emphasis is once again on the birthright. It is on Joseph, who was the firstborn of Rachel, and through whom the birthright was passed by Jacob. But Joseph had two sons. The oldest son was Manasseh, and the younger son was Ephraim. I hadn't necessarily, well, I'm tempted to want to cover more material than what I originally had here because there's just so much to deal with. I might go back to Genesis 41. Let's just go back to Genesis 41 and let's discuss Manasseh and Ephraim for just a moment. Since most of you know where I'm going in this message, most of you have enough information to know where I'm going already in terms of Manasseh and Ephraim and where they are identified in modern history. You know, you would have the notion that what I'm saying eventually, or what I eventually will say, is that Manasseh became the basis for this nation in which we live. You know, that Manasseh became the basis for America, and Ephraim for Britain and nations relating to Britain. And I don't think that's a shock to people in here that I should make that kind of a statement. But if you go back to the history of America, what's interesting about our history is that people who have come here normally from some, obviously they've immigrated here. They don't have roots here going back, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years in most cases. They have come from somewhere else, and they remember that. Their grandfather, their great-grandfather migrated here. And normally they came from a rough circumstance. They came from oppression, from poverty, from some kind of difficult circumstance, came to this country to start again, to start life anew, to have a fresh start. And this was a promised land, a land of opportunity for them. And it's interesting that when Joseph has Manasseh, in Genesis 41 and verse 51, Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh. Now Joseph, you know, means increase. Joseph, in effect, means prosperity. It literally means may he add. So it literally means, in a sense, increase. Those of you who know American history may realize that when the Puritans came to America, they knew the Bible very well. Those who founded the New England colonies, they were people who read the Bible in Hebrew and in Greek and commentaries in Latin. They knew their stuff. And there was one of the early families in New England was the Mather family, and they had one of the children in that family was named Increase Mather. If you study American history, you read about him. They called him Increase Mather because they were simply translating from Joseph. Well, evidently that never caught on as a first name in America. I've never met anybody named Increase. They just use the name Joseph now. But Joseph, it means that. It means increase or prosperity. And in fact, that's what his life turned out to be. He turned out to be somebody who eventually became very prosperous and brought great prosperity to others. Well, here in his firstborn son, in verse 51, Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my toil in all my father's house. So he named him Forgetting, because Manasseh had made him forget all of the woe and sorrow of the past. And really, America has played that role for so many people, hasn't it? People have come here to forget the past and get on with a new life. So that's really, in a way, how America has been. It's been a nation that has been sort of anti-historical. You know, we're interested in the here and now much more than in the past. And then in verse 52, and the name of the second son he called Ephraim, or fruitful. God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my afflictions. And again, all of you know where I'm going in this talk. It's nothing shocking. If you look at the British Commonwealth, if you look at Canada and Australia, you know, the huge wealth around the world and power that at one time was controlled by the descendants of Ephraim, if I'm correct in what I'm saying, then you could understand what the significance of a term like Ephraim would be, fruitful. Certainly it has been a fruitful people. Now, let me just say, as we turn to Genesis 48, just from this message, I'm not going to be able to make any of you agree with me on this. This is something that we have, over the years, studied, published, most of us believed. I think we have strong grounds for it. Obviously, you can be a fine church member, as far as I'm concerned, and not agree with me. But I'm going to at least make a case for it today, and in future messages, maybe we'll make a further case for it. And I do believe that it is important information for us to be aware of. But as I said, I can't box anybody into a corner and demand you go along with what I'm saying. Anyway, let's go on to Genesis 48 and verse 15. So now we're dealing with Joseph, who had these great blessings, these great physical blessings, and Jacob, his father, now sees the grandchildren, Manasseh and Ephraim. And as you know the story, he crossed his hands when he blessed Manasseh and Ephraim. So, acting prophetically, he crossed his hands so that, in effect, his right hand was over Ephraim, who was the younger. And that crossing of the hands is kind of interesting, because to this very day we tend to associate that kind of X symbol with the British. They have a flag called the Union Jack, and it has that, you know, big X symbol on it. Anyway, in Genesis 48, verse 15, and he blessed Joseph and said, God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them, and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now, brethren, I believe a person reading the Bible and taking it seriously is going to think, is this talking about more than maybe a small nation in the Middle East? Doesn't this seem to be talking about major nations, world powers, when you put everything together? It certainly is a reasonable statement to make, that we're talking about more than a small nation in the Middle East, but we're talking here about nations with major impact in terms of geopolitics here. And let them be grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And he said, let my name be named on them. Now, does that mean that, well, let's go back to verse 5. If you don't mind going back to verse 5, it's on the same page for most of you. Shouldn't be too much of a problem. And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Okay, Reuben and Simeon were the firstborn sons of Jacob, literally, because he had children by four women, by Leah and her handmaiden Bilhah, and by Rachel and her handmaiden Zilpah. So there are really four branches to that nation. And that is one reason why their descendants would not necessarily all resemble one another, because there are four different women involved here. But the firstborn of Leah, and the firstborn of any of the children, for that matter, of Jacob, were Reuben and Simeon. But he says here that these two firstborn children of Joseph will be like his own firstborn. They will, in effect, be raised in status, and instead of grandchildren, they'll be children, and they will have, in effect, the rights that would go with the firstborn children. They're coming from Joseph, who was the firstborn of Rachel, rather than Leah. So my point, brethren, is that it's not that he's saying the others are not Israel. That is not the point. The others are Israel. But he says these also are going to be included. They will be included as Reuben and Simeon. He says, let my name be named on them. Not that his name isn't already on the others. It is. But his name is particularly on these. And Joseph said to his father, let's go back to verse 17 now. So when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, as I pointed out, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. That's interesting, too. Now, little things like that mean a lot to me. And again, I can't make you, I can't sort of force you to agree with me as if we're in a debate and scoring points. But think about it. When he says he also shall be great, doesn't it seem that historically you might think that maybe Ephraim will become great before Manasseh, by the way he puts this? You know, he also shall be great. And that's in fact what happened. First, obviously, you had the British, and they became a powerful nation. And then seceding from them were these colonies that separated out and then became a nation and also became great, and even greater in one sense as a single nation. But the British became a family of nations, a company of nations. Anyway, to read on here, but his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he. Certainly we can appreciate that in this congregation. But truly, if you think about those who pastor us here, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. God blesses according to our talents. We had a president back in the 1920s, Calvin Coolidge, a very underrated president. But anyway, he had a brief, you know, term, four-year term, didn't say a lot. He believed in being silent. But Calvin Coolidge did say, the business of America is business. And America has certainly had that talent, entrepreneurial talent. We have had economic talent. On the other hand, the British ruled for many, many years an empire. They were able to administer multi-millions of peoples. For example, India. A few British were able to keep peace and order and achieve quite a bit of progress in terms of health and other factors in a place like India. And over time, these nations have become independent, but in many cases, they still retain a good relationship with Britain. Some, you know, had a hostile relationship and it was very ugly, but for the most part, they have just backed away from these nations, and then they have a commonwealth where they still interact with these nations to this day, and there's a certain bond, and the Queen of England is still the queen of many other nations. And they have had this talent for ruling and a talent for politics. Politics is not really our bag in America overall. I tend to be a political buff. I follow politics a lot. And frankly, Americans are not that interested in politics. They're more interested in making money. You know, and the British have tended to have more of a talent for politics. I know I'm generalizing, and I could be criticized for that. I'm speaking in general terms, and I hope that nobody will take this as some kind of personal slap in the face one way or the other. But I think you'll agree with me if you look generally where the talents are in America, where the talents are among the British-speaking peoples, and God blessed according to those talents, as you see here in what Jacob had to say. Now I want to go on and go to Genesis 49. Go to Genesis 49. One thing I wanted to do to kind of keep people awake and keep people interested, you know, back years ago, when radicals were trying to gather together their movement, radicals supposedly are people who are supporting the downtrodden, you know, people who are supposedly not that well off. So they're not going to have a lot of money to back their cause. Nowadays they can get it, particularly in Hollywood, I guess. But in those days, I guess times were harder. So the radicals would get together and they would tell people to take out a dollar bill, everybody, and you know, take out a dollar bill and wave the dollar bill, and they want to see a sea of green. So everybody with their little dollar bills, you know, would wave their dollar bills, and there'd be the sea of green, and so these radicals could raise their money. Well, that's what I wanted to do today, actually. I wanted people to take out a dollar bill. If you have one, take one out for just a moment, and I'll just briefly make some comments. If you don't have one, fine. I just want to make a few brief comments about a dollar bill, because it'll help you remember what I'm trying to say. And I'll do anything to try to get my point across within reason. You know, so just using a dollar bill will help me get my point across, though. So let's have our sea of green here. And if the deacons will come forward with their baskets... No. Anyway, let's go to the back here of the dollar bill if you have it. It's interesting, and again, this doesn't prove anything. This isn't something that somebody is going to be shrieking from and jumping from one of these chandeliers enlightened necessarily, but yet it's interesting when you look at the dollar bill and the symbolism on it. First of all, it is fascinating that on the back of an American dollar bill, we have a pyramid, an ancient Egyptian pyramid, somehow tying us back to Egypt. What is this fascination with the pyramid? Well, it is interesting, brethren. Where was Manasseh born? In Egypt. His mother was Egyptian. So Manasseh is half Egyptian. So is Ephraim. They're half Egyptian. And it's interesting we have the pyramid on our dollar. And another interesting thing about our dollar is how much biblical symbolism is there. The eagle and the olive branches and the arrows, all of these symbols, of course, are very much found in the Bible. If you look above the American eagle there, you'll see 13 stars, which form the shape of a six-pointed star, the traditional Star of David. But why is 13 so prominent on the American dollar? Why are this Star of David is formed by 13 stars? You all understand why 13 is so prominent on the American dollar. It's because we began with 13 colonies. It's very interesting how much the number 13 figures in American history. America began with 13 colonies. And if you look at this eagle, there are 13 stars above the eagle. There's 13 arrows that the eagle is holding. There's a flag on the eagle with 13 stripes. If you go over above that pyramid, you'll see a Latin inscription of 13 letters. You can count them. There's 13 letters there. It says, "He has prospered our cause." Then you, with the eye over the pyramid, meaning the eye of providence. The eye of providence. He has prospered our cause. Now, if you go to, again, the eagle, you'll find in the eagle's beak, if you can look at the beak of the eagle, you'll find in the eagle's beak a slogan, a saying, "A pluribus unum." which is 13 letters, which means out of many, one. Out of many, one, because we had 13 colonies that wanted to become one nation. So we said out of many, one, e pluribus unum. And again, there's 13 letters there. So 13 is very prominent in the history of the United States, beginning with 13 colonies. And there was a time, you can put away your dollar now if you'd like, there was a time, or do something else with it, there was a time when this country split and there was, and the southern states attempted to form their own nation. And you know what they did? They put out a flag with 13 stars on it. They didn't succeed, though. They didn't get 13 states. They only got 11. But yet on the famous Confederate battle flags that we tend to see around, would have that have an X on them, going back to the British symbolism, and they have 13 stars on that flag because the Confederates hoped to have 13 states. They didn't quite make it. They only had 11. Why were they hoping for 13? Well, they wanted to begin the same way the United States began, with 13. Since the Revolutionary War had 13 colonies, they hoped they would start with 13 states. It didn't quite work out. But it just shows the importance of 13 as a symbol of the United States. Well, now think about ancient Israel. This is just a parallel that's interesting. Again, it's not. I couldn't necessarily go to a university and prove a point with this. But you think about the history of the tribes of Israel. There were 12 tribes of Israel, but Joseph was given a double portion. And the dominant tribe was Ephraim. And then the other tribe, Manasseh, though older, was promised a major role, but yet secondary, later. So in that sense, Manasseh was a 13th tribe. And it is interesting how the symbolism of 13 has stuck on a nation that I believe, frankly, has come from Manasseh. I want to go to Genesis 49. And let's get back now to scriptures. If you don't like my dollar bill shenanigans, then please be patient. Now we're going to go back to the Bible. Okay, Genesis 49:10. Genesis 49 and verse 10. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. So there was a promise given to Judah of a scepter, the king, the monarch, the king, who turned out, of course, to eventually be Jesus Christ. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. You could translate Shiloh as he whose right it is. He whose right it is. Until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. So yes, it's very clear that Judah is given the scepter promise here. And that eventually leads to David and his family and finally to Christ. But now notice what is said about Joseph in verse 15. And see the lavish physical blessings that are talked about regarding Joseph. And there really is no time in history when you can really document that this ever happened, except maybe you could say during the time of Solomon. But there isn't any specific reference to it in the way you read here. In verse 15, verse 22. Joseph is a fruitful bough, by a well. His branches run over the wall. So it does seem to imply a nation of colonizers, an expanding people. The archers have bitterly grieved him. I remember how arrows figure in our symbolism nationally. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him and hated him, but his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. But the God of your father who will help you, by the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you, with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. This very eloquent, very powerful material. And one would want to see the Bible specifically in some ways pointing to a fulfillment. Or at least somehow we could look in history and say, yes, these wonderful prophecies were fulfilled. Joseph did receive this kind of history at some point. And I believe that we have found that. And I believe that Mr. Armstrong did come across that truth, that information. I'd like now to go to Numbers, the 32nd chapter, if I might. Numbers, the 32nd chapter. And here again, this is something that is interesting. It's an interesting parallel. I believe it's true. I can't necessarily make you accept it. But let's go back again to the history of Manasseh. Manasseh was a 13th tribe. There's something else interesting about Manasseh, that Manasseh settled the promised land in two branches. Even though Manasseh never became more than one nation, but Manasseh settled the promised land in two branches. There was East Manasseh on the east bank of the Jordan River and West Manasseh on the west bank of the Jordan River. And Manasseh always seemed to operate as in two branches. If you go to Numbers 32 and verse 33, notice just part of the story here. So some of the Manassites, I guess, wanted to kind of lay back and have their flocks and wide areas of land, and others crossed the Jordan River and perhaps were more mercantile, and they had villages and they farmed and they traded, and then there were others who stayed on the other side of the Jordan and just had more or less of a pastoral kind of life, and there were differences in mentality. And if you look at Numbers 32 and verse 33, so Moses gave to the children of Gad, to the children of Reuben, and to half the tribe of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan. This is on the east bank, the land with its cities within the borders, the cities of the surrounding country. So Manasseh, half of Manasseh remained on the other side. So Manasseh, in effect, was settled in two branches. You know, it is interesting that the United States paralleled that same history. The United States was settled by two branches. 1607 was Jamestown. 1620 was Plymouth, and it was that branch up north that tended to be the dominant one finally. But as you know, there was a civil war between the North and the South, and the first battle of that war was fought at a place called, interestingly, Manassas, Virginia. Though they never became separate countries, though. But this country has always, in effect, had these two branches, yet always, never did become more than one nation. That's a side point. Again, I can't make you accept, you know, necessarily the implications that I'm drawing from these things, but I hope that it's at least of interest to you. Let's go now to Deuteronomy 33. Deuteronomy 33. We can start first with what he says about Judah in verse 7, and then I want to again talk about Joseph. So you see again the balance back and forth, the emphasis back and forth between these. Okay, Deuteronomy 33 and verse 7. First, we'll talk again about what Moses says about Judah. When you're studying Genesis 49, you should study it in connection with Deuteronomy 33. Genesis 49 is a prophecy of Jacob for his 12 sons, and then Deuteronomy 33 is a prophecy of Moses when these sons have become full-blown tribes, and he is about to usher them across the Jordan, though he cannot go. And he again makes comments, prophetic comments about these tribes, as Jacob did before. In Deuteronomy 33 and verse 7, and this he said of Judah, hear, Eternal, the voice of Judah, and bring him to his people. Let his hands be sufficient for him, and may you be a help against his enemies. It's interesting that he prayed that Judah be brought to his people. You study the history of the late 19th and early 20th century. See where the Jews were living then. See where they're living now. It seems that, in fact, this prophecy has been fulfilled in our own lifetimes, that the people of Judah, at one time living mainly in Eastern Europe, have now come to live mainly in the English-speaking world, and the rest regathered in their own land in the Middle East. And in a way, these prophecies have been fulfilled within just our own lifetime. I'd like to turn now to what he says about Joseph in verse 13. And by the way, you can just imagine what I'm doing today is the tip of the iceberg. This is a kind of beginning, introductory kind of talk, as I'm saying. I'm not marshaling every weapon, you might say, in my arsenal. Verse 13, and of Joseph he said, blessed of the Eternal is his land, with the precious things of heaven, with the dew and the deep lying beneath, with the precious fruits of the sun, with the precious produce of the months, with the best things of the ancient mountains, this is verse 15, with the precious things of the everlasting hills, with the precious things of the earth and its fullness. And I'm not sure that all of that can be fulfilled in that one piece of territory you find in the Middle East that has been called Canaan, Israel, Palestine. With the precious things of the earth and its fullness, and the favor of him who dwelt in the bush, let the blessing come on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. His glory is like a firstborn bull, and his horns like the horns of the wild ox. And of course, this symbolism is very much associated with the English-speaking peoples. Together with them, he shall push the peoples to the ends of the earth. These are the 10,000s of Ephraim, especially when you consider the hundreds of millions over which they ruled. These are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. So, brethren, once again, you see powerful physical blessings that were stated regarding Joseph. And you look in history and you think, well, now where have these prophecies been fulfilled? Let's turn now to 1 Chronicles, the 5th chapter. 1 Chronicles, the 5th chapter. Now, let me say again, these are physical things, and they're interesting, and they're in the Bible, and they're a key to understanding prophecy. But they're not matters of salvation. They help us, I think, be more excited about the Bible. I think they help us to be more excited about how God has directed human history and how he has written so much of it in advance. I think they can become spiritual in a sense, but they are physical things. And obviously our physical ancestry is not critical. You know, there's neither male nor female, we understand, neither Jew nor Greek, as the scripture said, neither bond nor free. You know, these physical distinctions don't matter. Years ago, I was going to college in the 1960s in New York, and I was finally in Brooklyn, and I used to listen to the radio, and I used to hear the World Tomorrow broadcast on a station called WEVD in Brooklyn, New York. I don't know if any of you go back there or not, but in Brooklyn, you can pick up a station called WEVD, and that was named after Eugene Victor Debs. And if you know that name? Nobody? We don't have, see, that shows what I'm saying. Americans aren't that interested in history. Eugene Debs got 1 million votes in 1920 running for president. He was a very major figure in the labor movement. He was an important American socialist. Does it mean anything to you people? I'm just kidding. Anyway, so WEVD was named after Eugene Victor Debs, and it was a Jewish station. Somehow the World Tomorrow was able to buy time on that station. But it was a station that specialized in ethnic programming. So there were all kinds of foreign language programs on WEVD. And right before our broadcast of the World Tomorrow, there was a program in Greek over WEVD. And I used to pray, and I normally wouldn't get this personal before such a large audience, but I used to pray that somehow some Greek people, by accident, you know, would be listening to their Greek show, and then maybe they would stick around and they would hear the World Tomorrow program. And maybe, in that way, we'd have some Greeks coming into God's church. Well, believe it or not, it really did happen. And there was one man who, listening to WEVD, continued listening, heard the program, came into God's church. And years ago, he told me about it. His name was George Kovanis. Recently, he died. But I'm certainly looking forward to meeting him in the World Tomorrow. And I wanted to just make this comment about him, because he's one that we all, a lot of us know. And if we had a sermonette about humility, if there ever was a person who had a tremendous amount of humility, it was George Kovanis. Anyway, I am looking forward to seeing him in the World Tomorrow. And as I said, God calls people from all kinds of backgrounds. We have in this group people from all kinds of backgrounds that are sitting here now. And so, as I said, we don't want to get overly obsessive about physical inheritance or racial matters or matters of descent. This isn't where it's at ultimately. Where it's at ultimately is spiritually. The sermon that you heard on humility was far more important than the talk I'm giving now. If you walk out of here humble, you'll be much better off than if we walk out of here informed about where the lost tribes are. However, nevertheless, there's a place for this kind of information. And certainly God's church is the place, if there's any place for it. So I'd like to go now into 1 Chronicles 5. It is a genealogy. And it is talking about these things I'm talking about. Descent and race and national blessings and how they operated and how God directed them. In 1 Chronicles 5, we find that the birthright might have been Reuben's. He was the firstborn of Jacob, but he didn't receive the birthright. It was passed on. Passed over Reuben, passed over Simeon, passed over Levi. Finally, the scepter went to Judah, the fourth child of Jacob and Leah. But the birthright went to the firstborn of Rachel, who was Joseph. I'm in 1 Chronicles 5.
Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was indeed the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that the genealogy is not listed according to the birthright. Yet Judah, so we see the information here, that Reuben would have had the birthright, but it was passed on and given to Joseph. Now let's keep reading. Yet Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came a ruler, although the birthright was Joseph's. So it's very clear, 1 Chronicles 5:2. Judah prevailed over his brothers. Judah is the father of the ruler, Jesus Christ. David, of course, and then eventually from David, Jesus Christ. But the birthright was Joseph's. So we should not expect that Judah would be a major world power in a physical sense with all kinds of resources. That wasn't what nationally would happen to that nation. No, that should be a nation descended from Joseph, or actually nations descended from Joseph. And that, I believe, did happen. I'd like now to turn to Psalm 78. Psalm 78. To review again that there are two branches of Israel, a birthright branch and a scepter branch. And the spiritual blessing, in a sense, went to the southern kingdom. The physical blessing went to the northern kingdom. Psalm 78 and verse 67. Now, this is something that may cause some people to sit up in their seats, which is fine because we're getting late and I need to do something. Verse 67. Moreover, he rejected the tent of Joseph. I'm reading out of the Bible, not making this up. And did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but chose, verse 68, the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth which he has established forever. He also chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the ewes that had young, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So you see that God did not choose Joseph when it came to the scepter. He clearly says, no, I rejected Joseph when it came to that. I chose Judah. On the other hand, the birthright was Joseph's. That is clear. Psalm 87. One last comment regarding the fact that there is a difference between Judah and Joseph in terms of the biblical record and the history and the way you should have expected their histories to turn out. Psalm 87, verse 1. This is a hymn that we know very well. We have a version of it that we sing quite often. Psalm 87, verse 1. His foundation is in the holy mountains. The Eternal loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things are spoken of you, O city of God. Selah. Meditate on it. Think on it. So the focus of God's attention spiritually is Zion. But yet there are those physical blessings he gave to Joseph. And by now I think you're convinced that we need to be aware of, you know, what happened with them. Now they became separated. Those two kingdoms became separated. We can read in 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles a history of those two separate kingdoms. And we can read how that northern kingdom finally disappeared from history. Yet we can read prophecies about their coming together again with the coming of Jesus Christ, his second coming. Not as a carpenter who would die or a teacher merely, but a King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And when he comes, he's going to reunite those two houses. Let's go back to the book of Isaiah, to the 11th chapter. Isaiah 11. First, let's go back to Isaiah 8, if you don't mind. Since you're going to go back to Isaiah anyway, why not also go back to Isaiah 8? Isaiah 8. Notice what it says about God here in verse 14. And by the way, Peter refers this to Jesus Christ in his writings. So you can look these up in Peter's writings. You probably are more familiar with them there. But I'm actually going to quote from Isaiah 8 and verse 14. By the way the British say it, Isaiah, that's closer to the way it should sound in the Hebrew. Isaiah 8:14. He will be a sanctuary, it says about the God of Israel, but a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel. as a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. In other words, there's more than one house of Israel. Yes, there are two houses. There was a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, and they separated, and the northern kingdom got taken away, and it disappeared from history as a nation. But they are to be reunited. Isaiah 11. You all know what Isaiah 11 is about. You all know the symbolism of Isaiah 11 and verse 6. You're very familiar with that. And in verse 13, a scripture I referred to earlier, it talks about a reunion of the houses of Israel. Isaiah 11, verse 13. Also, the envy of Ephraim shall depart. Ephraim is the dominant tribe, so it stands for the whole northern kingdom. And the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Judah was the dominant tribe in the south and stands for whatever elements were in the south. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not harass Ephraim. Well, there has to be some way of identifying them for this prophecy to be fulfilled. Let's go now to Ezekiel 37. Ezekiel 37. Ezekiel is talking about God tying up all the loose ends, making everything straight, settling everything, working all of it out. These are things we're going to be hearing about as we keep the autumn festivals. So let's go to Ezekiel 36 and verse 26. We're talking here about the conversion of people in mass, in large numbers. And God is talking to Israel in verse 26 of Ezekiel 36, and he says, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. He has just begun to do that historically. You know, how many converted people have there been over the years? I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will keep my judgments and do them. Then you shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers. You shall be my people, and I will be your God. Has that happened to Israel nationally? These prophecies have not been fulfilled, but we look forward to their fulfillment. And they go hand in hand with what we read in Ezekiel 37, and we'll take up the account in verse 24. Ezekiel 37 and verse 24. Well, let's actually go back a little bit farther. Verse 21. Now, Ezekiel had been told to take two sticks. One stood for Judah, one stood for Ephraim. He was to put them together, indicating a reunion of these houses. When God does these other things, when His Spirit is poured out upon His people, when they're restored to their land, when they're converted, when all of these things happen. In other words, during the millennium, at the beginning of the millennium, we're going to see this kind of a reunion. In verse 21, verse 20, and the sticks on which you write, I'll start with verse 20 because I referred to the sticks, and the sticks on which you write will be in your hand before their eyes. Then say to them, thus says the Lord Eternal, surely I will take the children of Israel from among the nations, wherever they have gone, and will gather them from every side and bring them into their own land, and I will make them one nation in the land. So these different tribes all become one nation in the land, and that is in combination with their conversion on the mountain of Israel. And one king shall be king over them all. They shall no longer be two nations. They have been two nations in that sense. They still are two nations. Nor shall they ever be divided into two kingdoms again. And then it goes on and talks about the fact that spiritually also they will be straightened out. Both houses will be straightened out. Neither house has performed appropriately, to use an understatement. They shall not defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions. We heard about that from Mr. Orchard last week, some of the things he was noticing on television. But I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned, and will cleanse them. Then they shall be my people, and I will be their God. And in verse 24, David, my servant, shall be king over them. So David resurrected. He's obviously dead. He's not here now, we know. But he is going to be king over all these Israelites and over each of the 12 tribes, one of the apostles. I already read that promise to you to begin with. So we're going to have David ruling over Israel, and then over each of the 12 tribes, one of the apostles. That's what the Bible says. David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall all have one shepherd, and they shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. as we, may I suggest, are trying to do now. We are trying to do these things now. We are living now the kind of life they will live then. Somebody should, right? God should have some people on earth now trying to live his way of life so that we may then teach others how to apply his way of life later. We're certainly trying to apply it in a world that is very hostile to it. They will at least be doing it in a world where the peer pressure will be positive. I'd like now to go to Genesis 45. Genesis 45. Now there's a tradition among the Jews when they read the Old Testament, based upon their history and their knowledge of the scriptures, they say that the deeds of the fathers, the deeds of the patriarchs, are assigned to their descendants. That the deeds of the patriarchs are assigned to their descendants. When they read about what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did, and what they experienced, they realize that these are not just written as personal examples, though they certainly are important for that, but they actually foreshadow national experiences that Israel experienced. For example, Abraham was in Egypt, and in his wife was a captive of Pharaoh, and then they went out with great wealth. You know the account. Well, that was a foreshadowing of what happened with Israel as a whole. They were captives in to Pharaoh and went out with great wealth, and so on. So what happened to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is not only history, it is also prophecy. And if you read the account of Joseph and his brothers, think about the prophetic implications of that account. They did not treat each other well, did they? They did not act like brothers to one another. Their behavior was far less than that, obviously. And they went their separate ways. You know, at least 12 of the brothers went in a certain way, and then Joseph was in Egypt, and they lost account of one another. They didn't even recognize one another. When the brothers encountered Joseph, they didn't recognize him as one of their brothers. He knew who they were. They did not know who he was. And it was very shocking to them when they finally saw him and realized, yes, he's our brother. And he had to prove to them that he was their brother. It's a very dramatic account, and I'm in the 45th chapter of Genesis. Leading up to it, Joseph has been testing them. He's been putting them through this or that problem. And then finally, Judah comes before Joseph, and Judah seems to have this gift of persuading Joseph, a certain eloquence and a certain gift of persuasion. I might turn to another prophecy about Judah in Genesis 49, just food for thought, since we're so close to it. Let's go over to Genesis 49. This is just a little extra information. You know, since I have been a college professor all these years, I can't help but want to stuff as much information down everybody's throats as I can here. And there'll be a pop quiz at the end of the hour. No. Genesis 49 and verse 8. Genesis 49, verse 8. Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. And Judah means praise. And so he's playing on the name of on the word. He says, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Of course, David was from Judah, and David wrote most of the Psalms that are, you know, chapters of praise. They're poems. Now, what does Romans 2 tell us, by the way, in verse 28 and 29? That if you're spiritual Jews, your praise is not of men, but of God. So Jacob said of Judah, your brothers shall praise you. What God says of us is that if we are Jews spiritually, our praise comes from God himself. So you can look that up in Romans 2, 28 and 29. But I'm still in Genesis. Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemies. Now, in recent history, in some ways, that has happened in the Middle East. You know, the Israeli army has become legendary in what it has accomplished. But before that time, through the centuries, the Jews were a persecuted minority everywhere in the world. And yet, periodically, from their community would rise some powerful figure, maybe the advisor to the king, like Daniel, or maybe some important person in the banking field, like the Rothschild family in Europe. And in that way, they have preserved themselves over history, and their hand has been in the neck of their enemies. It's a very fascinating prophecy. Anyway, they have had, as I said, this ability to get through to Joseph and persuade. So let's go back to the account in Genesis 44. Judah is speaking before Joseph, and he persuades him. You know, he speaks very powerfully to him. And finally, Joseph is all broken up. He can't restrain himself anymore. It's a very dramatic account. Verse chapter 25. Then Joseph, I'm sorry, did I say 25? I meant 45. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." Genesis 45:1. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. So it did become maybe far more public than he intended. But it became a very dramatic event. Probably was talked about all through Egypt. In fact, later on you read that the Egyptians were quite excited about this family reunion because Joseph was so prominent in Egypt. They were very excited about this family reunion of Joseph and his relatives and his father. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. It was an awkward time in some ways. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." So they came near. Then he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not, therefore, be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life." So there was a reconciliation, a reunion of the descendants of Jacob. Now, I believe this is prophetic. When Christ returns, one thing that's going to happen is that the tribes of Israel are going to recognize who they are and who their brethren are and will reunite. And it will be a time just much more dramatic than this time, but this time foreshadowed it. It's going to be a marvelous time to see. And I certainly hope to be there, and I know that all of you hope to be there. When Christ returns, his people will repent, and Israel and Judah will reunite and will repent, as we read about in Ezekiel. We're going to have restorations and reunions of all kinds, you know, one upon another, as everything works out, as everything comes to a head, as God works, puts everything together again, puts all the pieces of the puzzle together again. And then the other nations of the world, as you know, will be blessed, and each one of them will come into God's church over time. I'd like to go to Luke 19. Luke 19. I do not doubt that I'm covering a lot of material that is not essential, but nevertheless, it is New Testament material. It is a material that is going to help us get a perspective on where world events are going and will help us understand our role and the work that we must do and will be a motivating force for us. I want Luke 19, verse 11. Now notice this parable. Here's a perspective that maybe you haven't thought about before. Now, as they heard these things, he spoke another parable. This is Luke 19:11, because he was near Jerusalem and because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately. Well, you know, God's people sometimes make the mistake of jumping the gun, being premature in their expectations. Verse 12, therefore he said, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. So here is Jesus Christ. He leaves the scene, and he's coming back, we know. Verse 13, so he called 10 of his servants, delivered to them 10 minas, and said to them, do business till I come. Now, brethren, if you look at the New Testament and the ministry of Jesus Christ, you'll have to say that the focus there is on the southern kingdom. He was in Judah and dealing with Jews in those four Gospels. But as you know, that nation, that people, didn't accept him in general. And where has the gospel been preached? Who has funded it? Who has spread it around the world? Where has God's church had its greatest freedom and greatest activity? In the northern kingdom of Israel, the descendants of the northern kingdom, particularly in Joseph. Joseph has been the haven for God's church. Joseph has been the major source of income of the work and the major base of operations for the work now for centuries. So these 10 servants could represent the 10 tribes of Israel, the northern kingdom. These are the ones who generally have done the work of the church rather than the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom doesn't even have the New Testament today. Notice their attitude in verse 14. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. You know, as John 1:11 tells us, he came into his own and his own received him not. And so the gospel has been preserved and preached among peoples of the northern kingdom as it is to this day. But Zechariah 12, a chapter, I remember a very memorable time in my life was when I had a heart-to-heart discussion with Mr. Armstrong about Zechariah 12. Zechariah 12 does show us a time when Christ will return and when Judah will accept him. And they will repent in mass, and in fact will be the first nation to be converted in mass. Then the rest of the story I've told you today, they will be reunited with their brethren from the northern kingdom, and together will convert the world. Let's go to Acts 3, Acts the third chapter. And verse 19. Peter tells his listeners, and therefore tells us, since we can read it now, "Repent, therefore, and be converted, that your sins may be blotted out, so that times of refreshing may come from the presence of the Lord, and that he may send Jesus Christ, who was preached to you before, whom heaven must receive until the times of restoration of all things, which God has spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began. When that time comes, the tribes of Israel will be converted and reunited. Their wonderful future is one of the things we shall be anticipating as we celebrate the coming autumn festivals."